Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, the New York Island, the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 372, recorded on Sunday, May 9th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hey, Rachel.
On this week's episode, we're talking about the WPA strikes of 1939, and especially the Minneapolis WPA strikes. While strikes occurred across the country that year in reaction to a rollback and more conservative reform of the WPA, which we'll talk about, the incidents were perhaps most intense in Minneapolis. So let's talk first a little bit about the background of the situation nationally and in Minneapolis at the time. So, of course, we're talking about the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, the jobs program created as part of the New Deal to combat unemployment in the Great Depression. But as the Britannica article on the Works Progress Administration notes, the name of the program was actually changed as part of the 1939 reforms, and for some reason was renamed to the Works Projects Administration. In that year, increasing charges of mismanagement and of abuse of the program by workers led to a reduction in appropriations, and a strike by construction workers against wage cuts was unsuccessful. And of course, in 1943, they terminated the program during the war because the wartime economy had found employment for pretty much everyone. So our biggest source today, among many, will be the Minipedia or MNOpedia article on these events. That website, if you haven't heard of it, is, quote, an online encyclopedia about Minnesota developed by the Minnesota Historical Society, MNHS, and its partners. It is a free, curated, and authoritative resource about our state. All our articles are prepared by historians, consulting experts, professional writers, and others who have been vetted by MNHS. And we will actually also be citing today from the Minnesota Historical Society's main website, among other sources. You can always find all our links posted in a PDF with the episode as usual. So, as the MNOpedia article says, in the summer of 1939, workers went on strike across the nation to protest budget cuts to the Works Progress Administration imposed by the Emergency Relief Appropriation Act. While they did not bring about the act's repeal, they kept their jobs and were allowed to return to work after the strike. Minnesota was the only state in which strikers faced criminal charges for preventing people from working. So before we get into talking about the reforms at the WPA and the events in Minnesota, let's talk a little bit about why Minnesota in particular. And I think this relates in part to the recent legacy of the 1934 Minneapolis strike with the Teamsters and so forth that we covered on episode 346. But there are some differences. Yes, there was still a militant labor presence in Minneapolis, but this was also a new era for Minnesota politics. There was a new governor, 32-year-old Republican Governor Harold Stassen, who later became notorious for running for president at least 9 times before his death in 2001. But at the time, he was this sort of rising wunderkind. So he came to power in Minnesota on a platform of cleaning house in the civil service after the single 2-year term of Governor Elmer Austin Benson of the Farmer Labor Coalition. Benson, who was obliterated for re-election against Stassen in 1938, had been elected in 1936 to succeed Floyd B. Olson after his death of cancer in 1936. Olson, as we talked about on that previous episode, was a committed leftist and had built the backbone of the Farmer Labor Coalition's party finances on the strength of its Minnesota civil service members in state government. And its political power was built on the strength of farmers, workers, immigrants, radical labor groups, and civil servants. So Stassen was trying to attack and dismantle that power base, but he was also, I guess, trying to do it in sort of a delicate manner that would ensure that his popularity was increased rather than sort of alienating everyone. So it's interesting to see him navigate these events in 1939, as we'll talk about. Benson, the former governor, who was also actually a former appointed U.S. senator before his governorship, had been close to Olson and remained a key figure, although a doomed one, in Minnesota and national politics through the 1940s. Now, along with the new governor, Stassen, the city of Minneapolis itself had returned to the control of former mayor and retired Minnesota Army National Guard General George Emerson Leach, a reactionary Republican, although he's not to be confused with the guy we talked about on episode 346, Minnesota National Guard General Ellard Walsh, who had peacefully but firmly managed the 1934 strike with the National Guard and Governor Olson. Now, ironically, Leach's reputation was actually in good standing at this time, partly through the actions of Floyd Olson, who, as we talked about on that episode, had previously served as district attorney and in that capacity had conducted anti-Klan purges and aggressively prosecuted an elaborate conspiracy by members of the KKK to libel Mayor Leach with a false affair claim. And we talked about Olson's anti-Klan campaigns in episode 346, but we didn't mention that specific one. So that's a little bit of background on what was happening in Minnesota's political scene when these events unfolded with the WPA and sort of the radical labor militancy in Minnesota in response to those reforms. But we do need to talk about the strike itself and the content of the reforms, which were important not only nationally, but for Minneapolis contextually specifically. So Rachel, could you talk a little bit about, and this is again going back to that Minipedia article, could you talk about the role of women in particular in the Minneapolis strikes that unfolded?
Yeah. So prior to the main summer strikes, in early 1939, Minneapolis WPA officials dismissed over 900 women workers, defending the decision by saying that the women could obtain income from aid to dependent children, or ADC. For most, however, getting ADC was impossible. Even if they qualified, waiting for processing would deprive them of income. As the job cuts continued, the women organized, and in May, 1,500 workers voted to take a one-day strike. On June 2nd, more than 5,000 workers marched to the WPA's Minneapolis office to demand reinstatement for laid-off workers and an increase in the budget for relief work. The one-day strike in March, however, did not succeed. So tensions were already rising prior to the summer of 1939. And then there were reforms to WPA, which effectively meant wage cuts and fewer jobs. So on Saturday, July 1st, 1939, a new law went into effect, the Emergency Relief Appropriation Act, also known as the Woodrum Act. Under this law, WPA positions were slashed from $3.35 million to $2 million, and the WPA budget was cut by $773 million. Skilled Twin Cities workers' hourly wages dropped from $1.25 to 71 cents. The result was the largest nationwide strike up to that date in U.S. history, with close to 500,000 workers on strike across the country. So on Tuesday, July 4th, workers walked off their jobs at the Minnesota State Fairgrounds. By the end of Wednesday, July 5th, 13,350 workers were on strike in the Twin Cities alone. Workers in all sorts of projects walked off the job: plumbers, electricians, steam fitters, sewing workers, and library workers. Even drummers in the Federal Symphonic Band refused to play. And Kelly also has some lead up to the strike actions.
Yes. While we've talked about how local politics interacted here in Minnesota, this was also a federal project and largely caused by federal action, the strike. So I'm going to read briefly from a Minnesota History Magazine article from their summer 1971 edition. Before the Woodrum Relief Appropriation Bill took effect in July 1939, WPA workers had been receiving the prevailing hourly wage of the area in which their project was located. For a skilled craftsman, this meant that he was paid the prevailing union hourly wage, and each month he worked the number of hours required by this wage scale to make up what the WPA termed his security wage. The new act, however, stipulated that all project workers should work 130 hours a month for their security wage. The bill was drafted as a means of standardizing the number of hours required of the diversely employed WPA workers. A consequence of the revision would be a cut in hourly wages for all workers. The reduction would be the greatest for building tradesmen and other skilled craftsmen who, though union members, would be working at less than union wages or scabbing in competition with their own unions. And so this was a pretty significant shift in the pay for WPA workers. And notably, it happened in a very rushed manner. It was the Woodrum Relief Appropriation Bill was passed on June 30th, about 4 hours between the end of the fiscal year, was quickly signed by FDR. I believe this was on a Friday, and it was supposed to go into effect on Monday. When workers got to their workplaces on Monday, they saw this bulletin posted that their wages were being decreased quite drastically, particularly for those skilled workers. And there's also confusion at the work sites themselves. There's evidence that some of the project leaders believed that this wouldn't go into effect until July 13th, the beginning of the next pay period. Others thought it went into effect immediately. So this was an extremely big change for many workers. They would be working more hours for less money. And it happened in a rushed and unclear way, which led to quite a bit of confusion and pandemonium on those first days of July, making it all the more impressive that strikers launched into organized action so quickly.
So in addition to that problem, another problem the strikers faced is that due to the 1939 reforms, there were far fewer jobs available, so there were plenty of unemployed people willing to take the remaining positions. And WPA Administrator Lina C. Glotzbach declared that anyone who failed to report to work by Monday morning, July 10th, would be fired and replaced with eligible workers on the relief rolls, the federal government's list of people looking for jobs. Previously, when there had been a labor dispute at a WPA project, it had been shut down. So keeping projects open meant that workers would continue protesting. The Woodrum Act reforms to the WPA also contained a bunch of provisions anticipating strike actions because it was so drastic to the working conditions for these workers and other resistance to the reforms. They prohibited a hard picket, which is a picket where workers physically prevent scabs from going to work by blocking entrances. The hard picket violated Section 28 of the Woodrum Act, which stipulated that any person who denied another's relief benefits by means of fraud, force, threat, or intimidation was guilty of a felony. And also, the FBI deployed undercover agents to infiltrate the Minneapolis strikes and find hard picket violations so that hundreds of strikers could be arrested on felony charges with potentially long sentences. And we'll go into this more in a few minutes. So violent clashes ensued after Glotzbach's announcement that workers would be replaced on July 10th. On Monday, July 10th, fights along the picket line occurred at the sewing project headquartered at 123 2nd Street North, and it was closed for the next 5 days. On July 14th, there was a second battle at the sewing project, this time between pickets and police. A crowd of 3,000 had amassed in the area. Seemingly unprovoked, police fired into the crowd, killing one relief client and injuring 24. And at this point, government officials started stepping in and releasing quotes to the news media.
And one of those quotes came from FDR himself, who on July 14th said simply, "You cannot strike against the government," and specifically asked the press to quote him on that. Attorney General Frank Murphy at the time expressed a similar sentiment that you cannot strike against the government. Within a few hours, Thomas A. Murray, the president of New York City Building and Construction Trades Council, had responded, and he responded by saying, "You cannot force any American working man to work at his job if, for any reason, he decides that he is unwilling to do so. If the day should ever come when a man who abstains from his job because he is dissatisfied with the terms of employment can be coerced into resuming his job against his will, then our cherished democracy will be dead."
So locally, neither the mayor of Minneapolis, George Leach, nor the governor of Minnesota, Harold Stassen, wanted to deal with the strike. They argued that since the WPA was a federal project, the city and the state were not responsible for maintaining law and order. Over the next week, a joint strike committee met with Glotzbach and Stassen to come to an agreement. the bosses got the workers to accept their existing wages and working conditions, and the strike was settled on July 21st. Most of the laid off or fired workers were then reinstated or reassigned to their jobs. So this feels somewhat similar to the outcome of our episode on the 1922 railroad shopman's strike. There was a defeat in objectives, but a strong enough show of force by the workers to be rehired at the reduced wages without being fired altogether or ending up worse than before the strike. There is an exception. There was a large number of arrests in this case, which we will talk about now. Kelly?
Yes, so the strike had come to an end, but there was still a lot of sort of unfinished business as far as the legacy and the legal implications of this strike. In Minnesota, Minnesota in particular was the only place where strikers were indicted. And on August 18th, 162 people were indicted. 55 of those people were women. And bails were set very high so that the workers who had been WPA workers and the local labor organizations were just unable to pay them. So these folks sat in jail for a number of weeks before their lawyers were able to negotiate lower bails, since there was no evidence that there were any sort of flight risks. These people were tried not individually, but in groups, depending on the specific event, so the time and place of their involvement. And the judge said that groups larger than 25 people could not be tried. So these groups were smaller than 25 people, but interesting nonetheless that they were tried as a group. There were three separate trials. The first group of individuals was charged with having conspired and engaged in acts of violence at the university project. This was a group of eight people that were charged for this event. Two of them were acquitted, and the others were found guilty of intimidation and or conspiracy. The second trial revolved around an incident at a gravel pit and lasted only 3 days, very short trial, and three of the four defendants were found guilty, again, for intimidation and or conspiracy. And then the third and final trial revolved around violence at the sewing project, where one person died and many were injured. This group was a trial of 25 individuals. They had wanted to try more, but the judge said 25 was the largest allowable group. They were all found guilty of intimidation and conspiracy. And interestingly, in this trial, there was a lot of red baiting threats. The prosecution sort of insinuated that communism would become our country's government if we were unable to hold these people accountable for what happened on that day. Lots of that happening there. And all 25 of these defendants, as a result, were found guilty. And then the rest of the defendants had their case dismissed, as Roosevelt believed that they had, quote unquote, learned their lesson. So despite those 162 original indictments, only these three groups of people were actually tried. And most notably and most famously is this third trial of the 25 defendants that were all found guilty. And Rachel's going to speak a little bit more about that.
So interestingly enough, the Hennepin County Library hosts a Tumblr page where they kind of go into depth on some of the Minnesota history. So they posted an article with pictures about the WPA strike, particularly the Minneapolis Sewing Project. So in their article, they mention Edward Albert, who was one of the men charged in this third trial. He was a steward on the WPA sewing project, and he was present at the strike, but he pleaded innocent of any violence or illegal actions. Rather, he testified that he and other strikers had worked to help police keep sidewalks and streets clear, and that outsiders had instigated the violence. So despite these avowals, Albert and the entire group of 25 defendants with which he was tried were convicted in December 1939. And they were convicted on that Section 28 against the hard picket. So they were convicted of blocking the entrances, which led up to the violence where police shot into the crowd.
So let's go to the official sort of summary from the following year, provided in the May 1940 official report of the Bureau of Labor Statistics on all strike actions in 1939, not just the WPA strikes. They note that, quote, the building trades unions were especially opposed to the 1939 WPA reforms, as they felt that abandonment of the prevailing wage principle would affect union wage scales on private construction as well as on WPA projects. I think that's interesting and helps account for the reaction, as Kelly quoted from the New York City Building and Construction Trades Council, and also that we had pretty sort of widespread walkouts in places like Minneapolis, where there was more sort of union activity. We had talked in the previous episode about how Minneapolis used to be this sort of really hostile to union location. Nationally, the BLS reported that the number of workers, WPA workers, who were idle for one or more days in connection with these stoppages was about 123,000. Many more than this were idle for part of a day as a result of mass meetings and short demonstrations, which were held in protest against the new WPA regulations. But they also noted that many WPA strikers across the country returned to work in less than 5 days for fear of losing their listing on the government relief rolls permanently. As we noted earlier, part of this reform package included a pretty significant number of new provisions to essentially prevent or strongly discourage striking. And it's sort of remarkable that so many of these strikers managed to, you know, keep their jobs at all after the fact, that, you know, and not suffer any further repercussions, aside from obviously the ones we talked about on trial. So I wanted to talk now about just sort of general thoughts and reactions. I think all of us had never heard of this before. And I think, Kelly, you were commenting that this, despite the fact that this is one of the largest single strikes in the country, in terms of the numbers involved, at least for a day or so, there's very little information about this. I mean, most of the stuff we found had to do with the Minnesota events because that's where it turned violent and that's where the trials were. But this was something that was happening across the country. And, you know, it was happening before World War II. So it wasn't like everyone was caught up in, you know, the latest news from Poland or France. So why do we think it is that this just didn't really get that much attention? You know, I don't think any of us had ever previously heard that there was any sort of strike action against the WPA relief program, jobs relief program.
That is the question. I think part of it is that it doesn't really fit neatly into any side's political narrative. FCR, like an individual that is celebrated as one of our most liberal presidents, basically said government workers didn't have the right to strike, which is incredibly anti-worker. I think that this is not taught, not written about, not studied as much, just because it is so unclear where this fits into individuals' like political ideologies. I mean, so many these trials, I think, are a very interesting example because nobody was charged with striking. It was all these sort of like secondary smaller crimes. I mean, obviously with the exception of the person that was killed, but this general like conspiracy, sort of insinuating that striking is some sort of conspiracy, but not actually you can't charge anyone with striking because that's not against the law. And so I think that these trials in particular and the criticism of the strike in general were sort of on dubious legal grounds. And I think that it is hard to know what exactly to make of such an event, and that people don't readily apply a critical lens to history, as we all know too well. And this certainly doesn't fit into any one narrative very simply.
Yeah, and to your point, we also see this theme of Governor Harold Stassen and Minneapolis Mayor Leach, both conservative Republicans, not particularly friendly to labor, taking essentially a hands-off approach while this, you know, New Dealer president who wants you to join a union is saying you don't have the right to strike against the government. Kind of an odd political role reversal, as you were suggesting.
Yeah, I find that interesting as well. I think in previous episodes talking about these historical strikes, they're mainly against private entities and private unions. And I know we've talked about in the past, like some people argue that public unions shouldn't really exist, or that there is like a conflict between public strikes and private strikes. And I think this is kind of one of the first instances where we saw people who were public workers strike against their employer, which is effectively the government. So it's interesting to see how that has kind of shaped further public strike actions, and how people argue against striking against the government.
I think to go back to that quote that Kelly provided for us from FDR, you cannot strike against the government, and saying you can quote me on that. It calls to mind the Calvin Coolidge quote, which vaulted Calvin Coolidge to national fame and is, I think, one of the first examples of a public employee union attempting to strike against the government, which was the Boston police strike. We did a whole episode on that. But he said in that, there is no right to strike against the public safety anywhere, anytime. Now, obviously, he was a little bit narrower than that FDR quote. In that context, but you're right, that is interesting. I think also, while these were technically public workers because they were working on these big public, you know, WPA projects, most of the type of work that they were doing was in competition with potentially private sector work. And that was one reason why it was very important to the private sector unions, and I would assume the private sector bosses as well, that the wages be competitive in terms of prevailing and not outcompeting those private sector wages. So that's sort of an interesting dimension to this as well, I think, right?
Right. There's not exactly as much competition in, say, like a police strike versus this strike, or a teacher strike versus this strike. There isn't a huge private labor pool available to kind of take on the work that, like, there was in this instance, where there is private construction happening at the same time as public construction, and the government kind of cutting down that wage floor even further really does have a big impact on the private sector as well, which is a big contrast to those other public strike actions.
The other sort of point of comparison that I wanted to make here is, because we were talking about what some of these projects were, we mentioned several times, this was off-air discussion, but we mentioned on-air several times about the sewing project as a major site of clashes in Minneapolis. Well, what was the kind of stuff they were sewing? You know, various sort of professional uniforms and other sort of mass-produced sewing products needed for major sort of institutional sites like hospitals, prisons, things like that. And then that reminded me that a lot of the type of work they were doing is stuff that was probably also in competition with prison labor. We've done a whole episode about prison labor and the historical origins of that and so forth. And I think it's interesting, though, that these WPA jobs were being paid until this 1939 reform on a prevailing competitive scale with the private sector unions in the area, as opposed to being giving out like prison wages, essentially, which would have been, you know, rock bottom, if not completely non-existent. I don't know if that's a comparison that came to mind for anybody else.
No, I didn't think of that, but that's a very interesting aspect of that as well.
All right. Any other concluding thoughts on this before we wrap up?
Yeah, one thing that seems apparent is that FDR was no longer a fierce advocate of the WPA that he had famously been a part of creating, and used these trials and used these strikes as a way to start changing public opinion sort of against it. And as we talked about at the top, it would be, you know, discontinued just a few years later. But as a result of the war effort and the drop in unemployment, but also as a result of nobody really willing and interested in standing up for this sort of effort anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, you know, it's similar to how they had tried to make kind of some cutbacks on the New Deal, you know, around 36, 37 and so forth, kind of triggering the little recession within the overall sort of arc of the era we refer to as the Great Depression. You know, as you said, that sort of a counterpoint to the liberal reputation or the new liberalism of FDR, it's more of a classical liberal throwback, which is like, all right, this has gone on long enough. We've, you know, it's time to cut back on the relief efforts, and we got to tighten up the budget because these appropriations just can't be sustained. And then, of course, you look at the enormous amounts of money that the government was willing to shell out in World War II just a few years later. And it's pretty clear to us in hindsight. Obviously, there are conservatives who disagree. They're wrong. But there are, you know, it's obvious to us in hindsight that any time that they tried to cut back and reimpose more austerity during the Depression, it just made things worse and it didn't really fix the situation. And what was actually needed was just a truly massive scale injection of income into people's pockets all across the economy so that they could get back to spending and going about their day and supporting their families and their communities. All right, Kelly, thank you so much for being on this week to do all this research with me and talk about this WPA strikes in 1939.
Thank you for having me.
And Rachel, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.